I'm Walt Morris, and this is Christian Growing Pains, Part 2. A couple of minutes of fast review. Our basic premise is that God has created us for lifelong growth. And we underscore lifelong. And a corollary of that is that genuine Christian growth almost always, if not always, involves some pain. That's normal. That's the way life is. And when we do experience that kind of pain, it is natural, it is normal. They are simply growing pains. We talked about our adult life as a journey. And for lack of a better symbol, I drew the three-wheeled vehicle. The vehicle is our vocation, our God-given call, given by grace, and has three elements: identity. And our foundation identity is given to us in baptism, but it takes on different shapes as we move on this journey. Life work, that activity which uses our gifts for service in the world. It's a tangible expression of our life purpose. And then the third wheel of that vehicle is relationships. These need to be dealt with at each season of adult life. We don't only deal with them once. We need to deal with them time and time again. And then to underscore one thing, this, which I did say, but I'd like to say it once again. There are no life issues for the Christian that are not spiritual. For most of the first hour this morning, you probably thought I was talking in psychological terms. But sometimes we can hear that kind of language better than we can hear what we call God talk. Because when we use God talk, we're always tempted to think that real Christian growth comes out of the blue and it's in a separate compartment. No. Christian growth comes out of the stuff and even the garbage of daily living. All of the stuff that goes on. Now, I was not watching the watch this morning, but I would like to take just a few minutes now to ask you to do a short exercise. And after I finish saying what the exercise is, I'll tap the hood to give the man in the tape room the information that he'll put the tape on pause, and then we'll do our thing, and I'll tap it again when we're ready to come back. I would like you to think for just a moment about first of all, go back to the time in your life when you were just out of high school or in your early 20s. And I want you to think about a person who was important at that point, a person who was influential, that helped you to become an adult, that helped you set your life direction, a person that was important to you, a person that helped you make a turning point. I'd like you to just take a moment to think about that person. That's to tell the tape man to start the tape again. One of the things that I hope you might have gained from that exercise, if you took part in it or if you just did some of your own private thinking, is to realize how God can use other people at critical turning points. And your late teens, early 20s is one of those critical turning points. And I mentioned this morning that even though many of us are past that early adult era, it is important for us to go back and trace what went on in our own lives so that we can see how the Spirit has worked in us in order to give us some clues as to some of the ways in which the Holy Spirit can work in us from here on. Now, we went into some detail about the early adult era. We talked about some of the issues. We talked about the age 30 transition, second thoughts about work, second thoughts about marriage partner. And then, as is typical, if we sort of get things worked out, there's a relatively stable period. And Levinson calls that settling down. Normally in the 30s, that's when the male who's in the world of private business or in the corporation puts his heart and soul and time and energy into his work. That's the time when the wife and mother, if she's the stereotypical wife and mother, devotes the bulk of her energy into the children. And not so incidentally, she does it pretty much by herself. That's the time when clergy figure they've really got to get in there and make it. That's when they really bust their guts. And that's when pastors' wives get ignored and they rightfully start feeling sorry for themselves. Because, you know, the male has sort of grooved in and he's going to make this goal, whatever it is, really going to work hard. But so often, that's the wheel that suffers. Relationships, particularly wife and children. But nonetheless, things seem to be fairly stable. And just about the time when we think that things are fairly stable, they often start to become unstable. That's the rhythm of adult life. We go through transition, and if we get it worked out, there seems to be a stable period. And no sooner do we think we've got things organized, we've got life organized, when something happens to muck up the works. Now, later on, there may not be time in this hour, but in the third hour, which is on Thursday, part three of this, we're going to talk about all of the things that can louse up this neat diagram, because all kinds of things that can foul up the schedule. But for now, we're talking about what we can call the normal growth process. We seem to be so created that there begin to be stirrings within us that we often do not recognize, that wave flags for us if we do recognize them, that some change is coming. And the way it comes is that we begin to feel restless. Again, questions surface. Questions that we hadn't asked before. And we gain some consciousness that we hadn't had before. Somebody has said that midlife begins on the day that we wake up and the realization dawns on us, I don't have that much time left. We call that the consciousness of mortality. When we're in our 20s, the future is infinite. We've got time for anything and everything. We figure, so we start something and it doesn't work, there's plenty of time, we can start over again. At some point, late 30s, around 40, somewhere's in there, most of us get this understanding at a gut level of mortality. And we begin to think in terms of time left. And that throws the whole game of life, this whole journey of life, into a very different gear, into a very different bag. Because then we start asking some very profound value questions. The man who's been really working is gonna make it to the top, make it to the goal, is gonna get this dream realized, suddenly faces one of two realities. The first reality is that he's made his goal. And it turns to ashes in his hands. Or that is to say, here I've been busting my gut to do all this neat hard work and make it, and so I've made it, and what does it mean? What does it mean? What's it for? Because you see, he's thinking in terms of time left. And quite often, what men have spilled their lifeblood for and sweat turns out not to be worth it. You see what that does to our value system. So, we've all read, I'm sure, in magazines and books about men who at that point run off. And leave all responsibility behind. Because they really have difficulty coping with it. Sometimes they feel trapped because they've got a wife and kids. Kids may be ready for college or whatever. I can't stay in this job just to make money to send my kids to college. Can be a very painful kind of thing. By the way, human beings have known for a long, long time about this particular kind of life transition. How many of you have read Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey? Or do you know what I'm referring to? In the first half, in the Iliad, Odysseus is all male. Everything works. He wins all his battles. His ships and his men function the way they're supposed to. But then he's going to come back. And that's what the Odyssey is about. And this is his midlife journey. Nothing works anymore. Nothing works anymore. The old ways of doing things that worked so well up to that point no longer work. He starts out with 12 ships and through various mishaps he's down to 3, and pretty soon they're gone, and his last ship is wrecked. He's sucked into a whirlpool and all of a sudden it spits him out, and all he's got is a piece of the keel of his last ship. And then he has all these adventures. And he finally gets back to his wife. But the ancient Greeks had a real understanding of this process of the life journey. And if you read the Odyssey in that light, it suddenly takes on brand new meaning. Well, the issue of is this what I want to do for the rest of my life? I said the first thing that happens to the male is that I made my goal, and now I'm wondering if it's worth it. The other thing that can happen is that there comes the consciousness that I didn't make my goal. I'm never going to get rich. I'm never going to get famous. I'm never going to be president of the company or vice president or whatever. I'm never going to get, this really big farming operation going. Because that was my dream. I'm never going to do it. So now what do? I have to deal with the shattered dream. And that can put a man into the pits. So what then needs to be done? As the value of one's work, and of course, we men, you see, our sense of identity is so tied to our work. And I suppose that clergy, or male clergy at least, are prime examples of that. You see, I'm a pastor. That's who I am. That's my identity. That's what I hold on to. You see, and the first time that really dawned on me that was a problem was that year I spent in graduate school in 1970. And one day, one of my sons came home from school, and he said, "Dad, what are you?" And as I recall, my instinctive answer was, "Well, I'm a pastor." He says, "No, you aren't. You aren't functioning as a pastor." And he was right. You see, I was so tied to that role. And our kids really had a problem in that year. "What are you, Dad? Who are you?" Now, if the work that a man has been doing for 8, 10, 15 years suddenly turns up to be of questionable value, you see what that does to a sense of identity. If my work isn't of value, that means I'm not of value. We get all mixed up. So that leads to some interesting possibilities. The one possibility, of course, is that we can change our job. But we are pushed into an understanding of finding a life work. Finding that kind of activity, whether it includes our job or not, which uses our God-given gifts for service in the world. Now, that's a long, involved subject. What about women? If the woman is a wife and mother, at some point in this middle adult era, wife and mother begins to realize that her kids are going to be leaving home one of these days. Who am I then? You see, women have been brainwashed into thinking that motherhood is a lifelong occupation. It isn't. It's only one period of life, and then you get fired. Then you get fired. And it's not very healthy if you have the same kind of concern and involvement with your child who's 25 or 30 as you did when that child was 12. It's not very healthy to continue that same kind of concern. Well, if I'm no longer a mother, who am I? Women may also have to deal with some of the nevers. And one of the things that one of the other aspects of the current young adult population that is going to be fascinating to watch is the number of women who have chosen not to have children. And in spite of all of the nice rational reasons that many current young adult women give for not having children, at some point, right in here, there seems to be a consciousness and a very serious issue of having to deal with, I'm never going to have a child. The same issue is dealt with by that woman who never married. There seems to be something instinctive built in, and that tells a woman that she wants to have a child, and increasing numbers of women married or not are not having children. That's going to be one of the things that I'm sure is going to be a subject of research. Well, as women begin to realize that they've been fired, that they either have been or are going to be fired from the job as mothers, and they begin to wonder if they think about this, I could live for another 40 years, according to the tables. Am I just gonna cook for my husband for the next 40 years, if he sticks around? Is that really all that's going to fill my time? And so there's some profound issues that women also need to deal with. And then, of course, if we are married in midlife, one of the classic things, and you've all read about this and heard about the midlife couples who deal with the issue, do I really want to stay married to my spouse? If I'm going through crises, my wife might be impatient with me. She's got other things to do besides listen to my inner journey. And so I might end up feeling my wife doesn't understand me. Yeah. And don't have to go into detail as to the temptations that can be involved in that little process. Or vice versa. You see, one of the problems of midlife marriages is that very often a husband and a wife seem to be going in quite different directions. And it is almost as if they're like ships that pass in the night. What seems to be the basis of the husband and wife going somewhat different directions is that men very often in middle life begin to move into a somewhat different mode of life. That is to say, competition there. That is to say, men very often become interested in what we call the nurturing aspects of life. And many women who have been nurturing for the last 15 years shift gears and may begin to be ambitious. They begin to act more like males do. They want to get out and move out of the nurturing role. And so friend husband says, gee, just at the time when I need a little tender loving care, wife is going out to set the world on fire. She's got all kinds of ideas and ambitions. But it's also true that during our middle years is a time when men in particular can learn what it means to care about people. That's often the time when fathers realize what they missed when they were so busy back here, when they missed with their kids. And that's we talked about some of the guilt trips that mothers can go on this morning. That's one of the real guilt trips for men, that they didn't spend time with their kids. Anybody here, any of you men, have that little guilt trip? Yeah. Which brings us to the whole question of parents. That is, our parents when we're in this middle adult era. Remember I said this morning that one of the tasks of the early era is in some way declaring independence from your parents, but it comes back. That issue surfaces again in these middle years. And it can surface in a number of ways. And when it surfaces, our first reaction is, well, gee, I thought I took care of that when I was 21 or whatever. I left home and been on my own for all these years. But there are a number of ways in which in our middle years we have to deal with the issue of our parents. Once again, we're back in relationships and identity. Now, if in our middle years our parents are living, the issue may surface first. Why is it? Here I am, I'm 45 years old. I've got a family that I've been supporting. I'm talking from the male point of view now. I've been providing for a family. I've had a responsible job. But when I go and see mom and dad, part of me still feels like a little kid. Do you remember that? You went home, you're still the child. And here you are 48 years old. You still feel like a child. And that can be sort of disturbing. How do you deal with that? And then to complicate that, if at that point mother or dad or both need some special concern, maybe they're not able to take full responsibility for themselves. And then, here's very often where women come in, because it is still true that most often women take on the responsibility of aging parents, which is a subject of some conversation among women these days. Why should it always be daughter or especially daughter-in-law. At any rate, the bind of how do I become a parent to my parent? How do I become a parent to my parent? That's one of the really traumatic issues of middle years. Then there is the shape of this of the issue of dealing with parents. This is sometimes the era in which one or both parents die. I can recall vividly when I came back to Minnesota for my mother's funeral. And because I lived 1,000 miles away, I wasn't there when she died. And I came to the casket prior to the just prior to the service. And what hit me in that moment was, I'm the older generation. There were no aunts or uncles left. She was the last of her family. I'm the older generation. Again, we got to shift gears. For many people, that insight, that understanding, that realization takes a little getting used to. Because you see, as long as mother and or dad were still living, remember how something neat would happen to us and we could always call them and tell them about it or write about it and say, mother would like to know about this. And suddenly, she and dad aren't there anymore. We're the older generation. And that's part of this mortality thing that we talked about earlier. There's a third aspect on this parent relationship. And that has to do with if one or both of our parents died earlier. Illustration, my father died when I was 12 years old. And I didn't realize until a number of years ago that I had some unfinished business with my father. It had to do with what right did he have to die when I was 12 years old? Just at the point when I really needed him. That was one of the things I had to deal with. I also had to deal with some things about my mother. By that time, she'd been dead for a number of years. I had some problems with my mother, with what she didn't do for me, or at least what I perceived that she didn't do for me when I was in my teen years. She was, for all practical purposes, absent in terms of presence for me, because she was so devastated by the loss of my father. She wasn't really present for me. And so one of the things we're going to touch on in the form hour tonight is the healing of memories. And I did one form of that. I needed to. They say that was my perception of my mother, and I needed to accept that, what I perceived as a lack from my mother. It was important that I go through that because I had some rather deep feelings about that. So whether our parents are still living in our middle years or whether they've long since died, there's some stuff we've got to do. There's a process we've got to go through with our parents. One other little issue. I said my father died when I was 12. He was 52 when he died. If any of you men had a father who died early, I think you will know what I'm talking about when I say that my 52nd year was full of anxiety. And I have found out that that's true of every man who lost a father early. When the man reaches the age at which his father died, he's really quite anxious about that. And that's just one of the things that needs to be dealt with. Well, there's all kinds of things that go on in this era. It may or may not be in the form of a full-blown crisis. However, there is almost always some stuff that needs to be dealt with, because we change. We change, and when we change, we have to shift gears. We need to rethink our value system. We need to rethink our faith, if you will, and I'm going to talk about that in the third session, that not only do we have this linear diagram, not only do we have these three tasks of identity, life work, and relationships which make up our Christian vocation, but we have what we can call stages of faith. And that really complicates life. And we react quite differently in each of these changing periods or transition periods depending on the stage of our faith development. And we'll be talking about that in the last session when we're going to be concentrating on the late adult era. As I said, this midlife process may or may not be a full-blown crisis, but there's almost always some stuff that has to be dealt with. We need to learn how to change our view of ourselves, of our identity, relationships. Midlife marriages almost always require work. There needs to be some renegotiation, because people in their 40s that are married are by no means the same people that they were when they got married. And if they are, something is wrong. It can be really unfortunate if one of the marriage partners stays pretty much the same and the other one changes. The goal should be that both change, that both grow. But growth involves the pain of renegotiation of the marriage. If we've done our homework, if we've done the tasks that surface in these three areas, somewhere around age 50, there's a sort of a secondary transition, somewhat similar to the age 30 transition. That is, it seems as though we check out. Did I make the right choices? If we did our work well in our 40s, the odds are that we'll say, yeah, I did make some good choices. I was open to other people. I was open to the Spirit. I made some good choices. And there follows then a new period of stable living, which of course doesn't last all that long until turbulence starts once again. But that's where we end up. It was I changed, well, I really could say that my wife was very patient for 2 or 3 years when I was wandering around, figuratively speaking, in my mid-40s. Oh, I was still doing a good job in the parish, but in reality, I was wandering about. And things got worked out. My work issue got settled. A week before my 51st birthday, I changed jobs. And these last 6.5 years have just been a ball. I've never had so much fun. And I'm really looking forward to what the next change is going to be. And you see, that's one of the things about aging, is that you never know what the Spirit might have in store for you. That's part of the fun, is that you never know for sure what the Spirit has in store. And we've got this stereotype in our culture, you know, that aging is awful. Well, I suppose, obviously, there are some negative aspects. But in terms of who we are and who we can be in Christ, nothing is more fun than getting older. Because you never know what's in store. Well, we got some time left for some questions, comments. Thursday morning, I said our Bible study is on Jacob's midlife crisis. And that's a really neat story. And we'll tie in that biblical material and talk some more about this matter of the midlife crisis. Jacob had a humdinger. Yeah?
Something you didn't address was is also common for women to be goal-oriented or career-oriented in this day. And they would be having goals and such.
Yeah, right.
Their midlife
is probably going to, if, yeah. This is, you see, this is the problem of any scheme. All that we can count on is that things change. You see, for most of us in this room, we pretty much followed this neat linear pattern with some exceptions. And now the young adults have to come and mess up this neat scheme. You know, you hear the adult development scientists, they've got all this, they've worked years to get this neat construct. And we get women that just have to follow it up. Yeah, women who come into this early adult era who are strongly goal-oriented are going to have the same kind of questions in middle life, the same kind of issues. That is what I've been doing for these years really worthwhile? Absolutely. And should also, that brings to mind about women once again. My wife's mother died about 3-4 years ago, and my wife had a lot of stuff to process, because her mother was a highly competent woman. She was not educated. My wife's mother had the equivalent of a third grade education. She was brought up on the prairies in a really scanty part of North Dakota. She had to go out and work to support the family. So she had it was about a third grade education. And then my wife's father died early when my wife was a teenager, leaving my wife's mother with nothing. And that woman was able to put three daughters through either nurses training or university. Two of them through university. And still was able to provide for herself. Obviously, she was a strong woman. My wife is not exactly a wallflower, those of you that were here last week met her. But, you know, she had some stuff she had to process. And it took several months. That's normal. That's normal. That's natural. So women go through much the same thing. And now there are young adult women now who are goal-oriented. They're going to have to go through some of the same work questions.
Do you think that women who are gainfully employed, goal-oriented, whatever you want to call it, are as keen on being successful as men are? Do they feel that same drive, do you think?
Most of them don't. Most of them don't. At least that's my perception.
They don't care as much if they get promoted, etc.
Women don't misunderstand this. Women are different.
Amen.
And one of the ways that they are different is that they're not quite as concerned about that ladder of success, because they have quite a different value system, most of them.
Are you talking about all women? He was talking about the goal-oriented.
Yeah, I'm talking about, yeah. But
working.
Yeah, but even those who are somewhat goal-oriented, and I suppose many of us would say that any woman who who is working outside of the home is goal-oriented, relatively.
I think along that line that many women, maybe most women, don't understand how devastating it is for a fellow to get up to be 40 and realize he's never going to make it.
Yeah, this can be. That's why.
What's this a concern about?
Yeah,
we're doing all right.
Yeah, we're doing fine.
I guess I have to question that just a little bit. I think maybe because you get a novice, I don't know if you can generalize too much on whether women would be as success oriented. I haven't taken any statistics, but I have so many that come to my mind. Already that are. I mean, you know, they're really out there to.
Everybody's different.
And that is a lot of their life. Where it's changing, where I've seen that they're just. Then you got two in the household like that, and then that's like ships passing in the night. They're both out for their goal.
But see, one of the things that is going on in the women's movement now is that that what I call the wise voices in the women's movement are putting out the warning to women, don't act like men. Look at the mess that men have put this world into. And for goodness sakes, don't buy into that value system. And so that's what I perceive as the saner, wise voices.
One thing we do know, they want the same pay for the same work. We know that.
Rightfully so.
Rightfully, yeah.
Rightfully so. Right. Yeah.
I think there's a difference taking place that maybe is along that line where instead of thinking in terms of success, and you're successful and this other guy or other gal wasn't so successful in comparison, that rather it's a push for excellence and your potential, and it has little to do with what your peers are doing, but it's your own excellence.
And that is precisely in the secular world, they're beginning to talk now about excellence. We should have been talking about that within the context of our Christian faith all the time. The other area where that same concept has been is in the so-called human potential movement. That's in secular terms. But remember the verse from the passage from Ephesians, that we become, that we grow up into Christ as mature people, reaching the height of the stature of Christ. That's our potential as Christians. And that's what we're moving towards as Christians, is our God-given potential. And we all know that we fall far short of our God-given potential. But we're on the way, we're on the journey. We're open by God's grace to more of our potential. And we achieve our God-given potential by working with the stuff of which daily life is made. There are no life issues that are not spiritual for the Christian. I hope to see those of you that are still here Thursday evening, 7 o'clock, part 3. We talk about Christian Growing Pains, part 3. And we'll be dealing with the top of the diagram. Thank you very much. Thank you.